This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you this hour, underwritten by X-Chair, xchairtom.com. And on the line with us is Brian Welch. He is both a clinical psychologist and an attorney. That's an interesting combination. He's the author of the new book, State of Confusion, Political Manipulation and the Assault on the American Mind. His website, Bryant Welch, BryantWelch.com. And Bryant, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. It's nice to be here.
Thanks for joining us. So, what is your core assertion here in this book?
Well, Tom, your introduction there was a chilling bridge to what I'm talking about in State of Confusion. And the question I'm trying to answer is, why is the human mind so vulnerable to the kind of manipulations that led to Hitler? And, you know, differences have to be acknowledged, but it's a chilling in its the way it's so uncanny in its connection to what a number of us are experiencing in the present American political scene. State of Confusion focuses on the American mind, and less on the mind of Donald Trump and more on the mind of the people who are supporting him, and really, in fairness, those of us who have been opposing him, because we're not doing a very good job of it. So the thesis is to understand the current predicament in America, we have to understand the American mind in order to understand how it's vulnerable and how, in fact, we're being manipulated. And there is a hopeful note in the book. As dire as things are now, with neuroscience and things we're learning about the mind, if we will pay attention to it, we can improve our mental functioning and be less vulnerable to demagogues, whoever we think they are and however they operate.
On the tail end of 2008, back when George W. Bush was president, your book first came out, the first edition of it, and you were arguing that please correct me if I'm wrong, that basically all the lies that we had been told to get us into the war in Iraq, the lies about our ongoing torture programs, other things like that, that we had been so gaslighted that we had lost our ability to tell the difference between right and wrong, or for that matter, truth and fiction. Do I have that right? And B, are things worse now, or is this just a continuation? Is the Trump presidency the logical consequence of basically 40 years of Americans being lied to ever since Reagan started telling us that if you just cut taxes on rich people, everybody would get a pay raise?
Yes, you've got it just right. And as I said in the first edition of the book, the problem was not going to end just because George Bush left office. And the reason I wrote the second edition that we're talking about now, A State of Confusion, is that the mind has deteriorated, the situation has gotten a lot worse. If you want a little quick measure of that, conjure up an image of George W. Bush, and now conjure up an image of Donald Trump. And I think most of us have a visceral reaction to the difference between the two. But I talk about the way the mind works and why it was vulnerable to the kind of things that have started happening in the political world. And it's fascinating when you compare the kind of manipulations or gaslighting that took place with the Bush administration, for example, by Karl Rove or what have you. If you now look at the kind of statements in the first edition of the book, I marveled at the intricacy and complexity of the deceptive web that the far right was using in their mass media. Today, what's striking is how amazingly simple it is. If you look at Kellyanne Conway and what she says, she doesn't have to come up with elaborate deceptions. She simply makes a few assertions, and the American mind has grown so weak that it's not able to discriminate, to challenge, and to think critically. And I document why that's happened in the book, in State of Confusion.
Don't you think a lot of people just know that she's lying through her teeth, that Sarah Sanders is lying through her teeth? I mean, the press comes out and says, you know, Sarah Sanders told another lie today. I mean, it seems more like we're just going, yeah, I guess we're powerless to do anything about it.
Well, I think that's where I'm saying the liberal or progressive mind is weak. But the thing that we forget in all that is that close to a majority of Americans don't think that she's lying, and they don't challenge it. And if you watch CNN, you're going to have one perspective on what's happened. But I tell my progressive friends, if you're not watching Fox News, you don't understand the reality that's being fed to the other half of the American minds.
Yeah, it's true.
And that's where the damage is being done. Now, don't get me wrong. With the onset of Fox News, a lot of media have moved in the direction of devious communications and the styles that I talk about in some detail in State of Confusion. But the fact of the matter is, this country is being fed very, very different realities. So you sit there and you watch CNN or MSNBC, you've got one reality. You got to switch the dial and watch them both simultaneously, and it's stunning how different the world is being portrayed with the two different media capitals.
How bifurcated are we? To what extent do people who watch Fox News literally never go outside the conservative media bubble? They just listen to Limbaugh on the radio and read Daily Caller online. And to what extent do people who read Daily Kos or Democratic Underground or Alternate or something like that, not ever watch Fox News and just stay to Free Speech TV or MSNBC?
We are very bifurcated. That's the point that I'm making about if you're not looking at the other person's information and what forms their sense of reality in the world, then we don't know what's going on and we can't understand the problem. I'm trying to address that problem of our divisions in State of Confusion by looking at the mind. The most important thing the mind does for us is create a sense of reality, what we think reality is. Now, we think it's just something out there externally to be discerned and to be noted, but it's not. It's a mental function by which we select certain aspects of reality and we integrate them and we weave them into our own reality sense. When we have a hard time doing that, we don't do so well, and we don't like to be threatened by realizing there are other perspectives that other people have. So now, this is a country that's always had differences, but we've been able to tolerate listening to other people's perspective without being so threatened that we have to start hating these people and seeing them as evil. And that's the big problem that's confronting America. We can tolerate differences, but our mind's capacity to tolerate is breaking down because it's been under so much stress and it's outstripping the capacity of the mind to assimilate new information, to process the kind of traumatic experiences that are affecting our lives, and to withstand the kind of political manipulation and gaslighting that's permeating the airwaves and our public discourse.
To what extent are you suggesting that we need to start paying attention to them? It seems to me like, we need to figure out a way to get them to start paying attention to us, to the worldview that is shared by the majority of Americans, and frankly, the vast majority of people around the world in developed countries.
My primary message is that we need to start paying attention to our minds, to the way the mind works, ours and theirs. And when we begin to understand these mechanisms that I talk about in the book, what I call the battleground state.
No, but this all sounds very didactic, Bryant. What specifically can I do to get the guy who lives next door to me, there isn't one right now, but my next door neighbor who watches Fox News all day long to watch something else?
You can start with listening to him.
Right.
And not trying to insist with logic or reason that he should give up his views. But if you look at what I've said in State of Confusion, Tom, I've got a much more elaborate set of things that have to happen. They have to happen at the national level in the communication style of our leaders. They have to start at and they have to also take place at the individual level in our communication with everyone paying more attention to how the mind works, so we're less vulnerable to the kinds of manipulative tactics that are taking place, so we can employ mental hygiene on ourselves and on our families and in our community.
Okay.
And there are things we can do there if you'll take the time to do it.
Bryant Welch is the author. The book is State of Confusion, Political Manipulation and the Assault on the American Mind. Bryant, thanks for dropping by.
Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure.
Good talking with you. We'll be back. So the cover-up train is rolling on right now. You've got the guy who covered up Iran-Contra for George Herbert Walker Bush. Trump now wants him in the AG's office.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And it looks like he's probably going to get him. And, you know, the cover-up is going to go to phase two. But we'll see. We'll be back. And welcome back. This is just incredible. When you consider the fact that the guy who engineered the cover-up of Iran-Contra, William Barr, is now the guy that Donald Trump wants to come in and, in my opinion, engineer a cover-up of Trump-Russia. And the Republicans are going along with this. They're like, oh, yeah, this is good. You know, we should just, yeah. Nice guy. Anything he says is just fine with us. I just, you know, it's like, where the hell is this going to go? This is William Barr, Larry Chin writing over at Global Research. CIA covert operative William Barr, nominated by Trump for Attorney General. His role in the Iran-Contra affair. This is from Global Research, the Canadian website. He quotes numerous mainstream media pieces saying that respected legal scholar William Barr, he says, in fact, there's nothing to respect and everything to condemn about Barr's work as a key inner circle operative throughout George Herbert Walker Bush's rise to power, from CIA director to vice president to president. These aspects of Barr's resume remain whitewashed by mainstream coverage. They've been amply documented by whistleblowers and those who work directly with Barr. It's not his legal mind that we're concerned about. It's his ruthless mind. It's his corrupt mind. It's his willingness to basically reinvent history. At his AG confirmation, Barr vowed to attack criminal organizations, drug smugglers, money launderers. As AG, Barr would preserve, protect, cover up, and nurture the establishment, the apparatus that he helped create, and use the Justice Department to escape punishment. He stonewalled and stopped investigations into all Bush, Clinton, and CIA crimes, including BCCI and BNL CIA drug banking, the theft of Inslaw Promise software, and all crimes of state committed by Bush. He provided legal cover for Bush's illegal foreign policy and war crimes. That would include his, you know, attacks ultimately on Iraq, on Saddam Hussein, saying, we're gonna take you out. But, you know, Al Martin wrote this book, The Conspirators, Secrets of an Iran-Contra Insider. He says that the whole Iran-Contra enterprise is a huge operation that included drugs, weapons, terrorism, war, money laundering, criminal banking, securities fraud, currency fraud, real estate fraud, insurance fraud, blackmail, extortion, and political corruption that involved countless Washington politicians. He writes, Iran-Contra itself is a euphemism for the outrageous fraud perpetrated by government officials for power, profit, and control. Offhandedly, this inaccurate term entered history as shorthand for the public scandals of illicit arms sales to Iran, coupled with illicit weapons deals to Nicaragua. The real story, however, is much more complex. When George Bush, Bill Casey, and Oliver North initiated their plan of government sanction on fraud and drug smuggling, they envisioned using 500 men to raise $35 billion. They ended up using about 5,000 operatives and making over $35 billion. They became a government within a government, the whole Iran-Contra thing. And Barr is the guy who covered it up. We'll be back with your calls right after this. Stick around. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Brandon in Sorrento, Florida. Hey, Brandon, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Good.
To expand on what your guest was talking about, I did vote for Trump, and I am a conservative, more of a constitutional conservative, and I do obviously have liberal friends, and I find that when we do sit down and have a talk, we try to remain calm, and I find that a lot of us, we actually come to agreements that we all want the same thing. For example, we all support education. We all support clean water and the environment, especially here in Florida. But I think where we divide, I think my liberal friends finally understand is that I don't agree. It's more so whose responsibility is it, and that's kind of where we kind of there's a fork in the road. And I argue to them. I said I vote for someone like Trump so they can nominate, you know, Scalia type Supreme Court justices, because I don't feel like education, the federal government has that authority. I believe that's a state right. So that's the biggest difference is. Like for example, healthcare. I tell them, I said, look, I don't care if the state of Florida passes healthcare. I don't mind people having healthcare. If California wants healthcare, go ahead and pass healthcare. But it's not the role of the federal government, and that's to me. And once they understand that, then we kind of.
Why do you think it's not the role of the federal government, Brandon?
Because it's not one of the enumerated powers in Article 1, Section 8.
Really?
Government cannot spend money. The things that Congress can spend money on is clearly defined in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. And for example, education, the Constitution does not give the federal government that authority. Healthcare.
Okay, hang on just a second. Article 1, Section 8 opens with Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. And then it ends, still Article 1, Section 8, to make all laws necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers and all other powers vested in this Constitution, the government of the United States, or any department or officer thereof. In other words, it's not just limited to these 18 items. But, you know, how is the general welfare of the United States not affected by people being sick, particularly in an era where you have biological, terrorism, and you've got diseases that can, you know, just massively kill people, whether it's a mutated flu or whether it's Ebola? How is general welfare, which is in the enumerated powers clause of the Constitution that you so love, how is not fulfilled by having a national health care system?
So this is where I think you're wrong, and that is you're saying the general welfare clause is an open-ended clause.
Yes, I am.
And if that was the case, your enumerated powers would not need to be there. So those enumerated powers are kind of they make your logic flawed in a sense. You wouldn't need those.
No, because it doesn't say these are the only powers that the Congress has. It doesn't say that. It says the exact opposite. And anything else necessary to protect the general welfare of the people. What you have to have is not a constitution. You've got to have a consensus. When the majority of Americans agree that having Social Security is meeting the general welfare of the people, then you have Social Security. When the majority of Americans say, no, Social Security doesn't meet the needs of the people, then you don't have Social Security.
Okay, then, so you're saying Congress has ultimate discretion on whatever they want to do.
No, I'm saying that the people have ultimate discretion, and if they don't like what Congress is doing, they vote them out.
So if Congress wants to intern Americans, is that constitutional at that time?
No, that's specifically prohibited by prohibited by the habeas corpus provision in the Constitution. But you're changing the subject, Brandon. I'm saying, I don't see what's conservative about saying that because it doesn't say health care in the Constitution, government can't do that. It doesn't say that you have public roads in the Constitution. Well, I guess it says postal roads in Article 1, Section 8, but that's not public roads, that's just postal roads. We collectively pay for fire departments to take care of our houses when they catch on fire. Why wouldn't we collectively pay for health care? It'll save us all a fortune and it'll make our society healthier. What rational person would be opposed to that, Brandon?
Tom, why did they amend the Constitution to ban liquor? If they could have just done it for the general welfare of the public, why did they go through the amendment process?
That's a good question. I'm guessing because they didn't think that. They didn't think that. No, there's no gotcha here. My earlier point that you have to have the public support. They had to get 2/3 of Congress and 3/4 of the states to say we're going to ban liquor. Now there was a big crisis, and I'm guessing you're familiar with this back in the 1920s, where the 10:30 coffee break in the morning was actually a whiskey break, and a lot of people were dying in factories and dying afterwards and coming home and beating up their families. I mean, it was a real crisis, alcoholism in this country at that point in time. But we've succeeded in wandering off field. Brandon, thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
This is the problem with, you know, oh, we're all bound by this mythical perfect document. Come on. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And can we carry Corey now?
Yeah.
Okay. In just a second here, Cory Booker's going to pop up. He's right now interrogating the guy who is in charge of the George Herbert Walker Bush's cover-up of Iran-Contra. Here he is.
You see over-stigmatized, addicted people clogging our system. You see a system where, as Brian Stevenson says, it treats you better if you're rich and guilty than if you're poor and innocent. And you see disproportionately, overwhelmingly for drug crimes, African-Americans and Latinos being incarcerated. The importance of your job, and I'll ask you this last question, because you haven't met with me yet, you've given that courtesy to others, would you please meet with me in my office so you and I can have a heart-to-heart on the urgency, the cancer on the soul of our country's criminal justice system, is the disproportionate impact of that system on those vulnerable communities, including women, over 80% of whom the women we incarcerate, are survivors of sexual trauma. Can you and I sit down and have a longer conversation than these 10 minutes will allow on this issue?
I'd very much welcome that, Senator. You know, my experience back in 1992, when sort of blood
when he was advocating higher, longer imprisonment and higher penalties.
My ideas were actually first formed when I went to Trenton, and the African American community there essentially surrounded me and was saying, "Look, we're in our golden years. We're trying to enjoy our golden years, and we can't even go outside our house. We have bars on our house and so forth. Please, these gangs are running roughshod." So I developed this idea called Weed and Seed. And my attitude was, look, let's stop arguing past each other on let's attack root causes and let's get tough on crime. And I felt that for programs to work, like after school programs and so forth.
Okay, I'm going to pull a plug on this. You know, this is Barr basically trying to justify his tough on crime policies during the Bush presidency that just led to millions and millions of people, particularly people of color, being in prison. Hack in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hey, Hack, what's on your mind today?
As far as your argument on the enumerated powers in Article 1, Section 8,
right.
I can distill your argument in a few simple words.
Okay.
There is no "and that's it" clause.
Right. Yeah, you're right. There is no "and that's it" clause anywhere in the Constitution. The whole idea of enumerated powers being limiting is silly. I mean, you know, they were specific things that they wanted to say. For example, you cannot have a military for more than 2 years. That's in Article 1, Section 8. They didn't want, you know, because they wanted every 2 years Congress to reconsider whether they wanted to have a standing army during times of peace. They wanted to make sure that that Congress was raising money for roads for the Postal Service because they thought the Postal Service was so important. They wanted to make sure that Congress had the ability to pass basically patent, you know, monopolies for patents, trademarks, and copyrights. That's in Article 1, Section 8. I mean, there was just a bunch of stuff where this, like, this is good government stuff. This has to happen. But we're not limiting everything to this by any stretch of the imagination, Hack.
Yeah. You know, I'm saying, and from my understanding, the Constitution came about because the Articles of Confederation were too vague.
Yes. And too weak. Basically, when we operated under the Articles of Confederation, we were basically, you know, 13 states operating with a free trade agreement. It was like NAFTA. But there was no overall governance, and that's what the Constitution brought about. Hack, excellent point. Thank you very much for the call and for making it. Connie in Darien Center, New York. Hey, Connie, what's up?
Hi. I'm calling about the caller you had before break, not wanting to the government to pay for our health care, and
right.
it just angers me so much. What do people like him want? Could the government not pay for anything? And what do we pay our taxes for? They're rich to get their tax breaks, and the corporations get, that's where our taxes are supposed to go.
Well,
is that all they want?
Tragically, he's an example of you know what happened in 1946 when this group called the FEE, And I'm sorry, I don't remember what the acronym stood for back in that day. But the guy who was the head of the National Association of Manufacturers, which was the at that time the largest business lobby in the United States, his name was Harold something or other. He got together a bunch of guys. He got the three big auto companies. He got the two big steel companies. He got the two big oil companies. He got a whole bunch of guys together, and they put together this think tank, and they rolled out in 1946 this brand new thing called libertarianism. And it was a political philosophy that was designed to basically make palatable to the average person the idea that corporations would run everything and that rich people owned everything. And, you know, and the idea was that government is bad, the marketplace is good. The marketplace always makes great decisions, millions of them a second, and government makes slow decisions and ponder. And so therefore, what we need to do is we need to destroy government and replace it with billionaires and corporations running the show. And, you know, there's a bunch of weird little doctrines associated with that, like the enumerated clauses. These are the only things that government should be allowed to do. Of course, the founders didn't believe that. George Washington signed legislation into effect that provided for housing, medical care, and food for poor people in Washington, D.C. When they tried to turn that over to the churches, that was James Madison's first veto, was to say, no, this isn't a church function, this is a government function. It's nowhere in the enumerated powers. But these guys are ahistoric. They don't understand the history of this country. They're just buying the talking points that the Fee put together to promote libertarianism, which was rolled out. Mark Ames has written about this extensively. You can read it online. Libertarianism was rolled out as a way to make the domination of our economy by a small number of very powerful actors and autocrats, billionaire oligarchs, to make that acceptable, palatable. And he was the perfect example by parroting back those talking points. And what it ultimately leads to, Connie, and I think this is to your point, what it ultimately leads to is the death of government and the death of the middle class. You end up with a government and a social system that looks very much like what Charles Dickens wrote about in 19th century England, where you've got a very small group of very rich people who control 95% of everything. You've got an equally small group of people who are the middle class, who basically serve the very wealthy. They're the lawyers, the doctors, and things like that, but they're not really rich. And small businessmen, Scrooge was one of those. And then you've got the 95% of everybody else who were poor, and they actually operated under maximum wage laws back in that day. That's what you end up with, Connie, in a libertarian world.
I wish I could put it as well as you do. I wish people would listen to you. It's just aggravating.
Okay. So aggravating. Well, Connie, thank you. Thank you for your kind words, and thank you for calling him out. You know, you're absolutely right. I appreciate the call. From Connie to Richard, listening on SiriusXM, also in Santa Rosa, California. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Hey, good afternoon, Tom. How are you? It was interesting. I had that conversation with Brandon, and you guys were getting a little more in the minutia that I was going to say, but sort of dovetailing off of that is that I think the issue, and I actually had a great conversation with an individual. I went for lunch last week, and he's we're kind of in the same industry, and I took him to lunch, and we were talking, and it turned out he was very conservative, and it came up, but it wasn't combative. It was just good, healthy, hearty debating, and I just basically said to him, and I've always say this to conservatives, that I said, because you know he came up with the talking points, and I said, look, guys, you know, this is our sentiment as you know, if you understand how a progressive thinks versus a conservative, it's basically rooted in the fact that we have a substantive approach to life, politics, finance, religion. You have a procedural. I said, so you want to default to the procedural, and you say that it's up and down, linear this way and this way or no other way. I said, this is the problem with your philosophy, though. It inherently carries the seeds of its own, not just destruction, but incongruence.
Corruption.
Corruption, exactly. Yeah. Either historical, currently, or future, all conservatives will transgress against their own political beliefs. And guess what happens at that very moment? They turn substantive. Because now that it's on them, and it's not just bellowing outward, but rather turning inward, where they have to deal with the consequence of their decision, that now they want a substantive approach, a substantive look at what they did wrong.
And I think history shows the example is Ayn Rand is the best example of this. For decades, she preached that Social Security and Medicare were sins against democracy and against America. And also that the science that showed that tobacco was bad for you was just all BS. Then when she got lung cancer from smoking all her life, she went on Social Security, she took the disability, she went on Medicare, and they paid for her lung cancer surgery. So all those people who had basically, you know, voted to screw themselves by joining the Republican Party and the Libertarians and saying, no, we don't want Social Security, they were out in the cold, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, that's funny you mentioned it. Rand Paul was doing the hernia surgery up in Canada, right?
Yes, he's named after Ayn Rand, and he's going to Canada to get surgery. It's incredible because.
Yeah,
go ahead.
See what I'm saying? So, yeah. I mean, I didn't mean to interrupt. Forgive me. I was just saying,
good.
There you go.
Yeah, spot on.
The process of your own political philosophy, all of a sudden they pivot because, like, whoa, wait a minute, that's not fair. Oh, you think?
Yeah, there you go. Richard, spot on. Thank you very much for the call. I like that. The procedural versus substantive. In other words, we've got to follow this process. This is what Article 1, Section 8 says versus what's the goal that we're trying to accomplish here? Aren't we trying to make a society safe and healthy and free? I mean, can't we have all those things? Every other country in the world, any developed country in the world does. Why can't we? Again?
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more of your calls in just a moment. It's 46 minutes past the hour. And welcome back. Kathleen in Astoria, New York, watching us on Facebook Live. Hey, Kathleen, what's up?
Hi, how are you? I just wanted to say I was listening to your general welfare ability that the Congress has over our country to take care of our general welfare. And I was wondering if there was legislation they could enact, because the president has been appointing people to head agencies that are not only unqualified, but actually don't support the agencies that they're put ahead of, like the EPA,
right, or Betsy DeVos
now
Education,
has a lobbyist at the head of it. Yeah. Is there legislation that they could enact? Do they have the right to create legislation that could prevent future presidents from appointing not only unqualified people but people who oppose the agency that they're supposed to head?
Right, actors who are not just stupid; they're malicious. Yes, such legislation could be passed. There's a number of different ways it could be done, Kathleen. There's just as long as the Republicans control any branch of government, they're not going to allow it.
Well, right now the Democrats are in control. So, is it possible that could be something that
the Democrats
they could do
don't control the Senate, so they don't control Congress. They can't pass legislation. They only control the House. They could pass a bill out of the House, but it doesn't become legislation until it also passes the Senate, and then it's signed into law by the President. So, as long as the Republicans control both the Senate and the White House, it ain't going to happen.
So what about Republicans who actually care about the country and the environment? I mean, aren't there such...
Please name one for me, Kathleen. No, I'm serious.
Off the top of my head, I can't.
Yeah, I can't either. I can't think of a single Republican that I would say this person actually cares about our country. They care about the billionaires, they care about the oligarchs, they care about their political future, they care about how much money they can make as a lobbyist once they leave political office. In the case of Mitt Romney, he cares whether he can become president, because he believes that the White Horse prophecy in Mormonism told him that he's supposed to be the president of the United States during the end times, another bizarre end time philosophy. But I don't see anybody in the Republican Party who's saying we need, as a party, to work together with Democrats or just ourselves and pass legislation that's going to actually benefit Americans. I've had a contest on this program, Kathleen, for 15 years, where anybody who can name one single piece of legislation that was introduced into Congress by Republicans, that was passed out of Congress by Republicans, that was signed into law by a Republican president. Single piece of legislation that benefited
the
average working person.
Wasn't it Richard Nixon who created the EPA?
Over the objection, actually it was the Democrats in Congress, they controlled both the House and the Senate when Nixon was president, who passed the EPA. Nixon objected to it, and in fact, the EPA then, there was a second agency that was in charge of air and water that worked with the EPA, and Nixon actually vetoed that one, although they brought it back and overrode his veto. But you know, Nixon was put in a corner with the EPA. He did not want that. So no, that doesn't qualify. And the Republicans all voted against the EPA.
Well, I didn't know that. I always thought that he actually did care about.
No, that's part of the whitewash job that Republicans have been doing. You know, they're trying to resurrect the reputation of Nixon and Reagan. Those guys literally never did anything for the average person. Everything that they did was for lobbyists, for billionaires, or for big corporations. And like I said, for 15 years, I've been offering an autographed book to anybody who can name one piece of legislation. I mean, we have a long list for the Democrats, right? Long-term health insurance, long-term unemployment. Any of the books that I've written, I'll autograph it and send it to you. If you can come up with one piece of legislation that the Republicans have passed that has the primary beneficiary is the average working person. Sometimes, you know, they get some fallout, but never primary. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Carrie in Huntington, New York. Hey, Carrie, what's on your mind today?
Hi, how are you?
Great.
I've been listening to you since I was very young, and I'm originally from South Dakota, so this is a lot about how qualified you are.
Great. Thank you, Carrie. Carrie, your phone is sounding kind of muffled and fading out. If you could get your mouth as close to the microphone as possible, it'd be great. What's up?
Okay, is this better?
That's much better, yes.
Okay, so I was thinking about this when we were talking about the state of emergency. Trump calling the state of emergency, and even if the Democrats can keep him tied up in court to fight that, that would probably take a long time. But in the event that a new president is elected in 2020, couldn't they do something to reverse that regardless?
Yes. Most of the things that Trump can do and most of the damage that he can do can be reversed by a Republican or a Democratic House, Senate, and White House. And, you know, Lord willing and the crick don't rise, we'll hopefully get that in 2020. Carrie, but and a state of emergency as well, but an enormous amount of damage could be done between now and then. So, you know, we'll see where this goes. Kamala Harris is interviewing Mr. Barr right now. Here's just a quick clip from that.
Earlier today, Senator Leahy asked whether you would follow the recommendation of career Department of Justice ethics officials on whether you should recuse yourself from the Mueller investigation. You said, quote, "I will seek the advice of the career ethics personnel, but under the regulations, I make the decisions as the head of the agency as to my own recusal." You also said to Senator Klobuchar that you do not want to, quote, abdicate your duty since recusal decision would be yours. So my question is, would it be appropriate to go against the advice of career ethics officials that have recommended recusal? And can you give an example of under what situation or scenario you would go against their recommendation that you recuse yourself?
Well, there are different kinds of recusals. Some are mandated, for example, if you have a financial interest, but there are others that are judgment calls.
And let's imagine it's a judgment call, and the judgment by the career ethics officials in the agency are that you recuse yourself. Under what scenario would you not follow their recommendation?
If I disagreed with it.
And what would the basis of that disagreement be?
I came to a different judgment.
On what basis?
The facts.
Such as?
Such as whatever facts are relevant to the recusal.
What do you imagine the facts would be that are relevant to the recusal?
They could be innumerable. I mean, there are a lot of, you know, for example, there's a rule of necessity, like who else would be handling it. It could be.
Do you believe that would be a concern in this situation if you are, if the recommendation is that you recuse yourself from the Mueller investigation? Do you believe that would be a concern, that there'd be no one left to do the job?
No, I'm just saying, well, in some contexts, there very well might be.
This guy is just incredibly slippery. This is just, he's just incredibly slippery. But she's not going to get a straight answer to her question. Obviously, he's saying, you know, you give me a hypothetical. What do you expect? It's a hypothetical response. Arthur in Rio Vista, California. Hey, Arthur, what's up?
Hi. I wonder if you could just clear up something you said earlier on the show about this this bill that Mitch McConnell could end the shutdown with by just signing it.
Well, he doesn't have to sign it. He has to call for a vote on it.
Yeah, you said that in this proposal is $1.3 trillion with a T?
That's with a T, yeah. No, I'm sorry, $1 billion. You're absolutely right. I said T and I was wrong. It's billion. It's one point. And I don't remember, there have been several bills that have been put forward. One was $1.2 billion, one was $1.4, one was $1.6. This is one of those three, so it's over $1 billion for border security. Forgive me, Arthur. Mix up my trillions and billions
sometimes. So that's an overall budget for just border security, period, not not to build a wall.
Correct. Correct. But so some of it could be used to build walls. You know, it wasn't the $5 trillion. I mean, Trump was looking for a fight because he thought that, or apparently Sean Hannity thought, that if Trump had a fight with the Democrats and he could sufficiently demonize the Democrats, that he would be able to basically just beat them about the heads and shoulders until they collapsed on the ground and started whimpering. And then once he's won that battle, he can say, okay, you know, now I want XYZ, and if I don't get that, I'm going to hold another part of the government hostage. And it would just never stop. I mean, this is why you don't give in to hostage takers.
Right. Just another FYI, we were listening to Stephanie Miller yesterday, and a caller said, who evidently worked many years in radio, said that Fox 40 does not have a certification or license or whatever it is from the FCC. For news, it has only for entertainment.
No, the FCC doesn't grant permission for news versus entertainment. There's not a category like that, Arthur. So all they have to do is...
Oh, evidently that was... Okay, that
yeah,
was...
that was somebody who was misinformed. Arthur, thanks a lot for the call. It's great to hear from you. And thank you all for being with us today. It's a fascinating day. The bar hearings roll on. And we'll see if, you know, some Democrat can manage to pull some really tough question out of their back pocket and say, here, what do you think about this? I'm still waiting for him to answer about why he covered up the Iran-Contra scandal. In the meantime, don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It requires you. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit tomhartman.com.